listening to All the Best. I'm Belinda Lopez, and you're about to hear from a man called Phil Carswell. He's now 59 years old and he lives in Brisbane, but he's going to take us back a few decades and to Melbourne.
I was in my mid-30s, and Dad was near 80 and getting quite frail, and I went and visited him, and he was complaining that all his brothers and sisters had died and all his family had died and all his mates that he had, you know, during World War II and stuff, had all died, and that he was sick and tired of going to funerals. We sort of sat down and did a bit of working out, and it just turned out that I'd been to twice as many funerals as he had, and I was 35. I suddenly felt like I'd lived my whole life already. That here I was at the same stage as an 80-year-old bloke, having gone through the loss and the life experience and all that grief, all telescoped down into a few years that normally people are supposed to experience over a whole lifetime. I still feel like part of me is back there, back in those decades. That everything I'm doing now is almost like an afterthought, like the rest of my life doesn't really matter now because I've been through that enormous change and come out the other side. I know it's made me stronger. I know it's made me more resilient. But I also know that it shouldn't be something that any human being should have to go through.
Phil's talking about the HIV/AIDS epidemic, and its arrival in Australia was grim and frightening. But Phil doesn't want to tell a story about death. He wants to tell a story about living, about the people who fought the hysteria aimed at the gay community after the virus started creeping into the country. He's going to tell us a little-known story that it unpredictably sparked a social movement. Phil Carswell was at the centre of the storm and a driving force behind a very unexpected revolution. This is his story. It's produced by James Douglas and it carries a language warning.
The first reported cases of what turned out to be AIDS were documented in July 1981 in America. Decriminalisation of homosexuality happened in Victoria in 1980, only the year before. So you're talking about an environment where there was basically no positive representation of gay people in the media. There was police harassment. There were very few social venues to go. There were very few ways for gay people to meet each other. It was very much an underground community or environment, if you like. 81, we knew there were cases happening in America, so we knew there was something coming. And suddenly by the end of 82, we had a case in Sydney of an American tourist who got quite sick when he was travelling over here to Australia, and he died in Sydney. Then in early 83, we had the first case in Melbourne of an Australian person who had AIDS. When these illnesses started to happen in the community, it didn't take very long because of the strong gossip networks and interpersonal connections between people for word to spread that something was up and that something was going down that was really quite scary. You would see people and you could almost look in their eyes and know that they knew that you knew, that they knew they were sick and that something was about to happen to them and they were scared. And when they were scared, you got scared.
These days, it's hard to imagine a time when people didn't know what HIV was. But back then, the doctors didn't even know that it was a virus.
There were diseases that cats and horses and parrots get. I mean, it was one of those really... that was part of the surreal nature of what was going on. They were dying of diseases that would normally not be a human threat. Infections that normally our immune system keeps under control. People were losing 20 or 30 or 40 kilos in the space of a few weeks. And so you'd see somebody at a bar 1 month, say in February, and they were healthy and dancing and having a good time. And by July, they'd be a walking skeleton. Some of them refused to go out anymore and be seen, so you'd only see them at home. Others would quite bravely, I thought, go out and be seen around, but that the Walking Dead stuff was really quite pervasive. And when you tie that in with the fact that it was only just newly legal to be gay, to have one of the first things happening to you was this threat of illness, a lot of people could say, I feel wrong. I feel like I've done something wrong here. When in fact what they were doing was being who they were, and it just happened to be a conjuncture, a historical conjuncture of the disease and that decriminalisation. I think the moment that made me finally realise that I had to do something was I was reading some old leftist documents and journals, and I came across this quote that said, "Don't mourn, organise." And I thought, that's exactly what we have to do. Rather than sitting around being all po-faced about, you know, oh, this is terrible, this is woeful, we have to organise. We have to. Mourning isn't going to be enough. And I actually had a little badge made up with that on it. And I wore it everywhere. But I wanted to remind myself, and I want other people to remind themselves, that there was something we could do. We weren't going to go back into our boxes and lose the ground that we'd won so far in terms of legalisation and a place in society. I had conversations with people who literally were scared that we were all going to be tattooed and put on an island, or else even the very survival of the community was going to be under threat, that our venues would be closed down, that we would be hounded out of jobs, and that we would be forced into disarray, into a diaspora of some sort, yes, sent to Alice Springs or something. So that was a very real fear and threat that people felt. And I thought, no, I'm not going to sit back on my bum and just be sad and glum, because I saw that even though this was going to be a terrible thing, there was a potential, because of the increased interaction and understanding that was going to come about as a result of this epidemic, that we might actually make things better for ourselves. We formed a medical subcommittee, or health subcommittee, I think it was called, and there were four of us, Ian, Peter, Chris and myself. I'm the only surviving one of those four who is with us now. That group of four, we held a public meeting in June 1983. And we just did it by word of mouth. And we used the dental hospital auditorium in Parkville in Melbourne, and the room packed out. At my age, I mean, I was 25 at the time, it was the single largest group of gay people I'd seen in the daylight before in my life. And what we had on stage were seven doctors who told all they knew about what was happening with this disease. The basic message that came down was, be careful who you have sex with, and the final message was, don't fuck with Americans. And the trouble is, most of the people in the room had already fucked with Americans, or, you know, knew somebody who had and they had, and there was a chain. So you can imagine at the end of 2.5 hours of that, the atmosphere in the room was pretty down. And one woman who should forever be immortalised in Australian gay history, a woman called Alison Thorne, grabbed the microphone in the audience and said, look, we've got to do something about this. There were a lot of very talented people in this room. And looking around, she was right. We had doctors, we had lawyers, we had people who were nurses, we had people who had skills in support work, we had business people who were good at fundraising. And that was one of the real ironies of that meeting, that whilst they were all united as gay men, there was a huge diversity of skills and capacities, and that was our blessing. It was decided that we were going to elect a committee to speak on behalf of the gay community and to start organising around AIDS.
This committee was the Victorian AIDS Council, and Phil was elected as the first AIDS Council president. He immediately put everyone to work.
There wasn't a single person who didn't have a skill of some sort that couldn't be used by the AIDS Council. And that message got out very loud and very clear to people, and it was an incredibly empowering time. The trouble was, when the deaths started happening, that strength was really tested.
We further sing to God's praise Psalm 23, the Lord's my shepherd.
The first couple of funerals I went to were gut-wrenching, because it was often a situation where you had the biological family up the front, a few empty pews, and then down the back, a whole gaggle of the family of choice, including some drag queens and young men and so on, bawling their eyes out. And no one in the biological family knew who these people were, who were these strangers. And the priests often didn't know either. So the services were totally unconnected from what was really going on in that person's life. And they often were said to have died of cancer or some unremarkable cause. Then later, they started piling on each other. And I often found myself in a situation where I had to actually get a schedule out of which funeral to go to. There were often double bookings, and you had to dash from one funeral across town to another one, three or four in a week sometimes, a dozen in a month. The overwhelming feeling I got all the way through it was that the funerals were frauds, because it wasn't dealing with the person who really was there in the coffin in front of them. Unbelievably frustrating. There were times I wanted to get up and scream, "You haven't seen him half naked on the floor of Mardi Gras." I could have whole conversations where you have this slideshow of this little boy on the back of a pony and living with these little sisters and brothers, and then they have all these photos up until about the age of 18, and suddenly there's this big gap until the day he dies. And no one ever in the biological family understood that wasn't the same person. They were still clinging onto this romanticised child that they all knew, but not the person they became, not the person that we knew. And that was a bit that drove me crazy. And we'd often have to go off and have our own separate celebration and tell the stories ourselves.
You can imagine the tension that this is creating when two segregated communities are forced together like this. But the AIDS Council had begun to set up teams of support workers who would assist families as their son or their sibling became sicker. And at the same time, other teams were out in the community educating people about AIDS. And eventually, funeral by funeral, Phil could see that attitudes were changing.
I always have this image of little atom bombs going off in the suburbs, one after the other, that as this awful diagnosis happened, as these care teams were invited into these people's homes, that these families who'd never met the gay community before suddenly met these amazing people who just gave of themselves so much and cared for their sons. One of the experiences I remember most vividly was watching the family of one of the first guys who died, watching them accept the stream of strangers coming into their home and then nursing him so carefully and patiently through the final few weeks. I was up in Sydney at the time and I heard that he was close to dying, and so I got on the plane and flew straight back home again. And he happened to be the person who developed the support program, Peter. He sat up in bed. It was quite hard for him to do it. But he said, "You know, mate, the system works." And he was so proud of the fact that the training and the organisation and the recruitment and the placement of teams and the personal development stuff that had gone on had actually led to a situation where, ironically, he was one of the first recipients of that care. But his mum, his dad and his brother stayed on after he died and became a part of the AIDS Council as well. They saw his work followed through, and it wasn't just like a matter of, "Oh, he's dead now, go away, leave us alone." They became part of our family and we became part of theirs. I saw that happen dozens of times in dozens of locations, and that sort of stuff can't be ignored or forgotten about. It embeds in your heart. We paid a huge price for that space, but we managed to make some real inroads as well. In early 84, the health department realised that they needed to have people in the department who knew what they were talking about when it came to AIDS. There were examples in hospitals in Sydney where nurses were refusing to deliver food to people with AIDS. So they'd serve them pizzas and slide them under the door and then walk away and not have anything to do with it. So there was a huge medical overreaction, there was a huge social overreaction, and the health department and the government realised they had to do something about it. They basically hired us. They said to us, "Come in and work for us." And so I went in and worked for the health department. One of the key issues that came up very quickly was the blood bank. Donating blood was something that a lot of gay men did. Well, not only because of the social benefit of giving blood, because we were trying to be good citizens, but it was also a free and anonymous way of giving a syphilis and hepatitis test. So a lot of gay men would use it as a surrogate sexual health check, which sounds cynical and quite nasty, but in those days, you have to understand that many gay men had two GPs. They would have one GP for their general health issues, and then they would have their gay GP to talk about their gay stuff, you know, the sexual health matters and treating STDs and so on, especially if they were married. For some of them, rather than going and having a sexual health checkup, which was just too confronting because you never know who you might meet in the waiting room, they went to the blood bank. So the government was obviously worried that if this was a blood-borne virus, that there was going to be blood that was going to be tainted. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. We wrote to the State Health Department when we formed ourselves as an AIDS Council to say, you need to talk to us. We need to work together on this. And the Health Minister at the time couldn't understand why this bunch of strange homosexuals were writing him letters, and nothing happened. Nothing happened at all. Until 84. And in 84, we had one of the biggest political crises around AIDS. It basically centred on Brisbane when four babies got transfused with blood in November 1984, in the middle of a federal election campaign. It was announced these babies had died. They had died from AIDS. The minister's press secretary came down to me and said, you better get prepared that something big's going to break tomorrow. I said, can you tell me what it is? And she wouldn't. So I got up early that next morning, got the paper, and of course it was the headline. And it was almost like moving from rehearsal into opening night. We finally understood just what power this disease could unleash. I was scared out of my wits for about the first few hours. I was scared for the poor kid who had donated the blood, because we made personal contact with him and found out that his life had been turned totally upside down. But then as we saw the government respond in the way government should, I got more and more confident. If anybody ever tells you that governments can't move fast, they can. The announcement was made on a Thursday, and by the following Monday, there was money promised, there was a national advisory committee organised, there was a national AIDS task force in place, and there was a Commonwealth state cost-shared agreement in place. All done, all organised. Bob Hawke basically said to Neil Blewett, fix it. This can't be seen to derail an election campaign. So there was this enormous political maelstrom.
It was 1987. The gay community had worked hard to be taken seriously as a partner in the fight against AIDS. The Health Minister, Neil Blewett, asked Phil to join the National Advisory Committee on AIDS, or NACAIDS. It seemed like the gay community finally had a seat at the table in informing government and Australians about the best way to tackle AIDS, and a chance to dispel the myths and the stereotypes that had haunted it. But then NACAIDS itself released a TV advertisement that Phil wasn't even warned about. It was called The Grim Reaper.
It was developed by a subcommittee of NACAIDS, who only gave very, very vague reports back to the broader committee as it was being developed. And on Sunday night when the ad came on for the first time, I sat there and was horrified. It was a smoke-filled bowling alley with about 20 grim reapers playing 10-pin bowls, and the bowls were substituted by human beings. A sombre voice would come in and say,
at first, only gays and IV drug users were being killed by AIDS.
First, it was only homosexuals who got this disease.
The fact is, over 50,000 men, women and children now carry the AIDS virus.
And I just thought that only was a real slap in the face, as if our lives were less important than anybody else's. And if it was only just homosexuals who got this disease, then it wouldn't be a worry for the community. I was horrified by the sheer power of it. I was horrified by this notion that AIDS, and therefore, by extension, people with AIDS, were skeletons or death with scythes and having fun sort of causing havoc in the general community. When I knew for a fact that people with AIDS were trying to be you know, as responsible as possible and not being demonised. But then I also had a second thought. This is going to start a whole new dialogue.
But if not stopped, it could kill more Australians than World War II. But AIDS can be stopped, and you can help stop it. If you have sex, have just one safe partner, or always use condoms. Always.
Sure enough, the telephone hotlines that I'd been involved in helping to set up were absolutely flooded that night, and every night for the 4 weeks that the ads ran. We had calls about whether people could share swimming pools, whether they could share cutlery. We had one woman who rang the health department and said that she used a shopping trolley that had been used by a man before her who walked funny, and he had greasy palms, and she was worried about whether, if she used the same shopping trolley, whether she'd get the disease. And my boss, who was a straight woman, to her eternal credit, said, "Madam, it depends where you place a shopping trolley." So you had some ridiculous and stupid questions, but they were based on fear. They were based on ignorance. And what that did, what the Grim Reaper did was it made people ask the questions. The trouble is the campaign didn't really give them the answers. So it was left to the AIDS councils to produce our own supplementary campaign where we actually gave the answers to the questions as best we could. Because it had been on TV, suddenly it was legitimate to talk about it, and we were the people who knew about it. So we got all these invites to go in every school, every community group, every RSL, every surf lifesaving club, every professional association. And so apart from demonising people with HIV/AIDS, it did enable a national conversation. In fact, it demanded a national conversation. And we were well placed to be part of that conversation. It's ironic to me that something as awful and deadly and full of pain and loss and heartache as the HIV/AIDS epidemic was has led to a time now where gay people are seen more visibly and are included more openly and are not tolerated but accepted more fully in our society. It's been a long, awful road to hoe, but in the end, what we've managed to achieve, I think, through being seen as responsible and committed and compassionate and caring people, is that we aren't the monsters that our parents were told we are, and that we are, in fact, an essential part of any vibrant and loving community.
His story was produced by James Douglas. Phil was the founding president of the Victorian AIDS Council, which is celebrating its 30-year anniversary this year. He now lives in Brisbane and recently finished up working with Queensland's Health Department after a distinguished career in sexual and preventative health work. And if you head to our website, you can see a photo of the badge he first made up in the early days of his activism, Don't Mourn, Organise, and see the Grim Reaper ad in full. Check it out on our website, allthebestradio.com. That's it for this week. All the Best is produced at FBI Radio Sydney, now in association with Radio Adelaide, 4ZZZ in Brisbane and SYN in Melbourne. Our show is played across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. I'm the features executive producer of the show. Our production manager is Carly-Ann Keneally and our executive producer is Jordana Caputo. We're going to leave you with a song picked out especially by Phil Carswell. It was played at the first ever Candlelight Memorial held in Australia. In Melbourne in 1985. Phil organised it, of course. This is O People by Patti LaBelle. We'll see you next week.
If we are one big family, no one will have to pay to eat. If we live in a world you're a part of me, there's no need for disbelief. He is mine. and see. Think of all the opportunities.